Hello and welcome to The Front Page. It's Monday, January 16. I'm Racing Post editor Tom Kerr, and you're set for half an hour of the best discussion about the biggest stories in horse racing. So please do like, comment, share and subscribe. I'm delighted to be joined in the studio today by West Country correspondent James Stevens. Hello, James.
Hi.
And remotely by betting editor Keith Melrose and Ireland editor Richie Forrestal. Welcome both. There's really only one place we can start this week. It's a time-honoured sporting story. Michael Jordan did it, Paul Scholes did it, our own Lester Piggott did it, and now we have another name to add to the list of great sportsmen who have come out of retirement for one last hurrah. Davy Russell, whose retirement lasted barely a month before he was called to help out his old ally Gordon Elliott after Jack Kennedy's unlucky leg break. And all the more reason why we're delighted to be joined by Richie Forrestal, because Richie had the pleasure of interviewing Davy last week, very shortly after the decision was made that he will be returning. And the piece was in Sunday's newspaper and online for Members Club Ultimate subscribers. It was an absolutely fascinating read, Richie. How did you find Davy?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, sure. He was in good form, in fairness. I suppose I contacted him first on the day of Jack's unfortunate incident at Naas, and at that point we were looking for a standard post-retirement big read, and all of a sudden the topic became a little bit more interesting. But fair play to Davy, you know, he committed at the outset to doing the piece with us one way or another. He hadn't made up his mind, excuse me, at that stage what he was going to do. But it's just a fascinating yet another fascinating twist and turn in the career of Davy Russell. There always seems to be some sort of a bend in the narrative with him. He's always been compelling from that point of view, and this is just another example of that. He was in good form, you know, when we sat down for the interview. In fairness, he was very frank. I challenged him as much as I could on whether it was, you know, to do with his own ambition as much as anything else, or rather, as he would tell you, you know, more to do with helping Gordon out in a desperate situation. I think there's a bit of both at play, to be quite honest. I suppose in the first instance, we spoke an awful lot and we all wrote an awful lot about how when Davy retired, it was the end of a golden era for a certain generation of jockeys born in the late 70s, early 80s. And I think this absolutely demonstrates that. You know, you look at the stable of riders that Gordon would have had to draw on over the last decade, your Davy Russells, your Jack Kennedy, who I know is younger, but I'm talking about the delegation before that, as it were, your Barry Geraghty's, your Paul Carberry's, Robbie Powers, it would have been another one of that vintage. They're all gone. And now you have Jack, who is obviously the next generation. He gets broke up and all of a sudden there's a big hole as to who Davy can rely on and trust for these big days at the Dublin Racing Festival, at the Cheltenham Festival and so on. So it kind of illustrates that quite starkly, the absolute end of an era his initial retirement was, and we can see that now. It's obviously tough on Jordan Gainford, more so than Sam Ewing. Sam Ewing's only a kid, he's 19. I think he's only a handful of winners ridden over jumps, even though he's ridden out his claim that was predominantly on the flat. It's really hard on Jordan Gainford because, you know, he's 23 years of age. He's ridden a lot of winners. He's ridden some good winners for Gordon, including a grade one at Christmas at Limerick. He's ridden a Cheltenham Festival winner on the Shunter. So it's probably hardest on him than anyone else. You know, the fact that at this stage, Gordon wasn't willing to trust him enough with the grade one mounts, the big mounts.
What's your view on that one, Richie? Was it the right move? Because I suppose you can see it from both ways. First of all, you know, inevitably it is going to be a knock to the confidence of these young lads, whatever they say, and they've both said the right thing, of course. But equally, had Gordon let it drift for a month, perhaps there'd been a few high-profile reversals, and then he'd done this further down the line, it would have been much, much worse at that point. So he's acted decisively, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has, and he did it from the moment the incident happened at Naas, by all accounts. You know, he rang Davy on the day, so he decided straight away that he wanted him, if he was willing to do it. So, it is hard. I get that you can look at it and say, if things went wrong over the next month or two, it would be very hard on someone like Jordan. But the other way of looking at it, it's a fabulous opportunity for a lad who has a good bit of experience at this stage. So it is tough on him, and there's no point in dressing that up. You know, hopefully he will bounce back from it, and I'm sure Gordon will support him. It's not that he doesn't like him as a rider, it's just that he felt he wasn't ready at this point for the bigger ride. But it is tough on him. There's no point in dancing around that.
No.
You know, he was there as number two, and all of a sudden Davey has been trapped back in to take the job. And the thing about Davey, I mean, this is the other aspect to it. You know, when we spoke the other day, he spoke very much in terms of how he enjoyed the reception he got, you know, when he announced he was coming back, or even before that, when he went into Gordon's, when it was being spoken about. He spoke about it yesterday on Racing TV. And you do get the impression that he still relishes that bit of, you know, the attention you get, the spotlight you get in a position like this. And you go back to what he said on the day of his retirement, that he was sad to retire.
Mm.
And I do wonder, you know, if he was riding more of the better horses at the time. He was riding some of them, don't get me wrong. He, you know, Three Stripe Life at the time was a horse he was riding. Unfortunately, he's been lost since. He rode Irish Point to win a maiden hurdle. I think, you know, he was getting good rides. But Jack was number one.
Yeah.
And Jack had first choice in the majority of them. So I do wonder if the situation was different. If Davey was getting more of those rides, still would he have retired at all? Because when you look at it now with what we've seen over the last week or so, and what he said at the time, you know, that he was sad to retire, I just wonder if he was quite ready at all.
Yeah, you really challenged him on this in an interview, and which was what made it so fascinating, because Davey insisted he was only doing this to help out Gordon. You sort of drilled into whether the buzz, the potential of more big race glory was a factor. And you made a very interesting contrast with the retirement of Ruby Walsh.
Yeah. I mean, I think we all saw that at the time when Ruby packed up. He was done. And he was absolutely delighted and relieved to be done. And he was finished. And there were grade ones the next day. There was 2 or 3 days racing left at Punchestown. And he had no interest. Now, if Paul Townend, God forbid, had broken his leg, Ruby would not have come back. He was finished and he was glad to be out. Whereas you never got that sense with Davey. And, you know, he said himself, you know, he's coming back. He wouldn't be doing it if the horses that were there aren't of the calibre that Gordon is offering. So, you know, that speaks to his ambition again. He wants to still be riding the big winners, you know, riding the horses he was riding predominantly. And, you know, he did, as I say, he did have a few nice horses still to ride, but riding the horses he was predominantly riding wasn't enough to satisfy his appetite when he initially packed up. So, you know, there's a world of difference there. I mean, it definitely looks like Davey was keen to jump at the opportunity as soon as it arose. And if it happened a month down the line, he probably wouldn't have. And, I'd accept that. You know, if it happened on the eve of Cheltenham, you wouldn't accept him to come back. But when it happened, when it did, he was only too eager to jump at it by the look of it. And, you know, as I say, it's going to make for a compelling couple of months. We don't know when Jack will be back yet. I hope we'd all love to see him back at Cheltenham again because of it. You know, he's a fabulous rider, great young fella, and he's had so much bad luck. But I would imagine with a tibia and a fibula, he's going to struggle to be back ahead of Cheltenham. It's going to be a push. You know, you're talking about 8 or 9 weeks at this stage to Cheltenham. 10.
Yeah.
What is it? I haven't done it, around that, isn't it? You know, you're probably talking 10 to 12 for a tibia and a fibula, I would have thought.
Mm.
But hopefully, to the ball.
Yeah, we all hope Jack can make it back in time. But if Davey does ride at the festival, it's going to be a huge story. I mean, you sort of referred to him as one of the last of this golden generation of riders. I was struck in the piece that you wrote, but him talking about some of the messages he received when he retired for the first time, you know, including from the President of Ireland. Just how big a story is this across IRC, Richie?
Yeah, it's a big story. I don't know if the comeback has got quite as much coverage as the retirement did, put it that way.
Yeah.
There's a lot of press rooms have put a lot of mileage into covering his retirement and paying tribute to him and so on. And less than a month later, he's back again. So obviously it's been picked up on and it's been covered, but I think he got a lot more coverage for retiring than he has for coming back. But then, you know, Cheltenham is going to come up around the corner and that's going to be huge. You know, Cheltenham has always been a place where he has been at his absolute best. you know, when the pressure is on and when the demand is greatest, you know, expectation is greatest to perform, that's when he's been at his best. And you look back to last year, one of the couple of years he didn't ride a winner there. And of course he was beaten on Delta Work in the cross country by, or beg your pardon, he was beaten on Tiger Roll in the cross country by Delta Work. And we're going to go to March. Jack might not be back. And what's Davey going to be riding in the cross country? Most likely Delta Work as a short price favourite. And you just wonder if there's going to be a redemptive moment there when that comes to pass.
Certainly, it's going to be some storyline. Keith, can I just bring you in here from a betting perspective? You know, what's your take on Davey Russell and what difference does having him in the saddle make?
Well, I was just thinking while Richie was talking, he's probably had dislocated shoulders that have kept him out longer than this bout of retirement. So in those terms, I'm not actually concerned about how he's going to ride. And obviously we know Davey's a massively experienced and brilliant big race jockey. So as a punter, I have absolutely zero concerns whatsoever about Russell coming back. I do, in the sort of personal terms, I do feel very slightly for Jordan Gainford, because when Jack Kennedy first got that gig, he was at an earlier stage than Gainford is at now. Gainford's been seen as the big thing for a good couple of years now. So I can see the sort of why he might feel a little bit stung by all this. But in terms of if you're a punter betting on these horses, you have no concerns about Russell being back. He says he's been riding out all the time. He's not like, as Richie pointed out, Walsh, who just stopped one day and that was it. He's still been riding out. You know, he'd come in colder if he'd been injured. So absolutely no issues with that at all.
And James, I mentioned at the top of the show some of these famous names who have come out of retirement. Michael Jordan, of course, the most famous of all. What is it about the sports person coming out of retirement back onto the big stage that so transfixes us?
That's a very hard question, I think. And given it's only 3 weeks, I'm not sure it's going to be quite the same. I think it's the idea of sort of gone and coming back, and the idea of being able to seem like the end of the year, the door is shut, and suddenly it opens again to a great bit of success. It's sort of something that's, I mean, we've said it before, like some of the best stories are the easiest to understand, isn't it? To be able to say, I'm done, and then I've come back and won. Mm. I mean, this is a bit different. I think I've thought Richie's piece was really, really interesting, and a couple of the things he sort of said almost sort of seems like Jack Kennedy had sort of, this has taken a bit of time for him to emerge as number one, and the way he sort of talks about it, it's almost like it's sort of been a bit of a team sort of effort, and it very much, the team spirit sort of seems to sort of sell, i.e. Gordon sort of called him up and said, we need you, and it's almost sort of like a national service. He sort of, come on, I'm back in the mould. And the other thing with Jordan, I think same really feeling about what the two lads have said about him, and he used the word catapult him into it. I think the really interesting thing with the idea of Jordan having that opportunity is that he's suddenly going to experience pressure which he'd never have before. Because if you're number one for Gordon Elliott, it's not about at Cheltenham Festival, it's not necessarily about, okay, you're on an outside ride, which is what it had, and you've got to do your best for the horse and get the best place. When you're on that sort of favourite, other jockeys are aware of you, they're wondering about you, you sort of, they're probably going to try and ride their race, but also be wary of you a lot more, rather than they would when you're the second string. You know, they're almost sort of, not necessarily trying to get you beaten, but they're trying to just make things more difficult, more uncomfortable for you. And that sort of pressure is something you don't get unless you've experienced it. And there is simply no place like it, like the Cheltenham Festival. So they've gone with the experience of Davey. He knows those situations. He knows exactly what's going to play. And look, that's the biggest 4 days of the season for the stable. They want to make sure they get it right.
It's a very good point when it comes to making the choices and the pressure. As soon as James started talking about that, I remembered Brian Cooper when he had that choice before the 2016 Gold Cup, when he had the two Dons. And you could tell the pressure that was having on him. So that is the one thing that Gainford's not allowed for yet. And it just immediately came to mind as soon as James started talking.
Yeah, just want to put everyone on the spot here. Yes or no, was Gordon right to call Davey back?
Yes for me.
Yes. Richie?
That's not a nice question, Tom. I'm going to say no, because I think from Gordon's point of view, he needed probably to look forward. And as much as Davey is obviously Davey Russell and he's the icon, we all know him to be, you know, I just think from Gordon Elliott's point of view, he could have to deal with Jack again in a couple of months gone, God forbid, like, you know, if something happened again, and what does he do then? So I just think, you know, you talk about Jordan Gainford, I know you said one word answer, Tom, you talk about Jordan Gainford Like, he's ridden the Cheltenham Festival winner on the Shunter when he was expected to win. He's ridden the Bet365 Chase winner on Hewick. He's ridden a Galway Plate winner, a US Grand National winner on Hewick. He won the Grade 1 on Jerry Cullum at Christmas. I think he's a good rider, and I think it's a pity from my point of view that he hasn't got that opportunity.
And Keith?
No, it's the same as Richie, no, for much the same reasons. You know, he's got a brilliant young rider there. He's shown his faith in similar in the past. So I would have said no. I mean, it's not that David Ross is a bad option at all, but in a word, no.
Yeah, okay, fascinating. I'm with Gordon Elliott and James. I think it was the right call to make a difficult one, a very difficult one, but ultimately people in Gordon's position are there because they get paid to take those decisions. And we will see how it unfolds. And it's going to be a huge story at the Cheltenham Festival. And indeed for the next 8 weeks as we count down to that magic week in Gloucestershire. So we're going to move on to our second story. And we're going to come to you for this one, Keith. You're following up on a column in today's paper by Lee Mottishead.
Yes, Lee has written about, it's not affordability checks, it's source of funds, but it comes from a very similar place to affordability checks, which is a running story for a long time now. He's written a column where he's spoken to Joe Beavers, who, to people of a certain age who were around during the poker boom in particular, Joe Beavers is a name we'll all know, now probably best known as a rails bootmaker, and he's explained how the checks and the extent to which S-markets were checking his source of funds went to the minutiae of a couple of £100 he'd in there from friends and asking for their bank statements to prove his source of funding, given that his account was six figures in profit and the associated turnover we can infer from that profit figure. These are very small amounts that the S markets are being asked to check up. And it's a very sobering look at the way affordability checks source of funds and the way the Gambling Commission approaches current checks and the way bookmakers are running scared of them at the moment. And it shows a worrying trend. It shows that the white paper, having been dreaded for a long, long time, can't really come soon enough now, because at the moment we're absent of clear direction from government, and in place of that the Gambling Commission, and bookmakers are perhaps sending not the clearest of messages and second guessing the other side. And we have this situation where even people who, you know, you could tell what somebody that's got a prominent position like Joe Beavers is getting wrapped up in all this sort of carry-on.
Yeah, it's absolutely wild. I was astonished by this. We've all heard about affordability checks, the idea that you've got to send in your pay slips, your tax returns, P60s. But the idea that because someone has transferred a small amount of money to you, you then have to call them up and say, excuse me, I need your bank statements for my bookmaker. I mean, it's preposterous. The idea, you know, if your gran sticks £25 into your bank account for a birthday gift, are you going to then call her up and say, excuse me, William Hill, need your bank account details? The level of friction that's being inserted here and the degree to which people are being hit by one request after another with this sort of mounting difficulty level, you know, it's actually positively Kafkaesque at this point, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. And, you know, if this wasn't the 100th time I'd heard a story like this, I would have suggested this was bootmakers closing down accounts by stealth, which is, you know, it's what I suspected when I first started hearing this stuff. But there's just so many instances now. That cannot be what's driving this. It isn't what's driving this. And yeah, you ask the bootmakers directly, you get a very straight back answer, or you get a bit of spin. But we get hundreds of emails every week about affordability checks to the Racing Post. It's such a widespread issue now. This is just clearly people that are frightened of their own shadow. And is it their own shadow they're frightened of? Is it the Gambling Commission? It seems just such a deep-rooted problem, and we need that clarity from the white paper to sort it out now, I think.
Yeah. James, these emails we get coming in, actually, it's incredibly sobering to read them, because there's such a quantity of them. And it's from people who increasingly cannot comprehend why they're being caught up in these things, why they're being asked to do things. People, you know, using phrases like, you know, if I want to go and spend my money down the pub or on takeaways or whatever, nobody checks anything, but I'm spending a comparable amount of money and it feels like I'm having to jump through one hoop after another in order to spend my own money.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? And I think that sort of the theme of some of them is very much people who have bet on horse racing for all of their life, and they feel that their relationship with sort of gambling and betting on horse racing is safe and it's affordable, and that it's really sort of unsettling, as Keith sort of said, that you're getting these sort of emails and having to sort of prove your finances. It's a very sort of awkward sort of situation to be in, and whilst we have a lot of our people have emailed us and us to us and said their own situations. You know, they're fans of the sport and they're people that will find a way because they enjoy betting, they enjoy the sport of horse racing and they want to have a bet and they may find ways around it. But there'll be a lot of people and some people even on some of the emails are saying, oh, I'm just simply not doing it. You know, there's a real problem here because obviously these affordability checks, for all they're probably not perfect, they are going to sort a few things out, and where money comes from is always interesting, and laundering and stuff like that. But unfortunately, the methodology and how things are being put together, it's going to be hitting normal people, and it already is.
Mm.
And in that sense, it's just clearly not working. I mean, the white paper, we still sit here. They're only down the road in Westminster. They just need to shake it up because I feel like almost the sense I've got is it's almost a bit panicky now.
Yeah. I think racing is starting to wake up to this unfolding nightmare which is happening. But my concern is I have no confidence whatsoever in the white paper to actually provide clear direction on things like this, because the idea that the white paper is going to say to the Gambling Commission, rein it in, you've gone far too far, I think it's just fanciful. We're going to continue then in this position where people trying to have a bet are subject to restrictions, which, for example, someone trying to open a stockbroking account to, you know, bet on derivatives, which is gambling in almost exactly the same form, is unlikely to have anything comparable. One other story I thought this week on a similar subject that was interesting was the Gambling Commission Deputy Chief Executive. Never knew the Gambling Commission was so big it needed a deputy chief executive. Sarah Gardner, she was speaking to the Danish Gambling Authority this week about the black market, basically dismissed it, said she thinks the risks are being overstated. She said the commission had no time for claims being made without what she called credible evidence, and basically defended what the Gambling Commission are doing and said, you know, we cannot swerve away from our duty as a regulator just because or there's a fear of the black market. But I sort of listen to these stories and I think, well, you know, you're actually causing enormous damage to regulated bookmakers now. You are driving many punters out of that ecosystem. And it's inevitable that a significant portion of them are going to end up finding other ways to bet. And they will try regulated, lawful way, things like retail or betting rings before they try the black market, presumably. But some of them are going to end up in the clutches of the black market. Some of them are going to end up betting through operators with no protection, with no interest in looking after their customers, and also just losing money because these are unscrupulous operators.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think the term black market has a bit of it's all a bit dodgy and stuff. But actually, when you think about the realism of it, is that ordinary punters don't want to have to give their information away. And second of all, the other thing that I hear a lot from people who bet is that accounts being restricted and they can't have so much on. You know, as you say, it's that market and that way of gambling is going to seem a lot more attractive just because the main right way of doing it is almost so wrong and affecting you personally. I mean, it's not as if, I mean, they say there's no evidence of it, but seems a bit naive, doesn't it? If there was evidence of it, it wouldn't really be a black market. But
well, indeed, yes. And a good point about restrictions there. One of our correspondents this week had a great line. He said, apparently now you can't bet if you win and you can't bet if you lose either. He said, maybe I should just set up a direct debit to my bookmaker and be done with it all. What a fiasco. Richie, I mean, you've got a very profitable line in looking across the IRC and rolling your eyes at the idiocy of things we do in Britain, but this one surely takes a biscuit.
Yeah, it's hard to believe, isn't it? I mean, I'm a bit caught up this morning for some reason. I didn't even realise it. We live in a free world where, you know, drinking is legal within certain parameters and all the rest of it. So is smoking, so is gambling, and whatever these vices, you know, whatever view you take on the vices, they're legal. And why there is this much interest coming on gambling at this stage in Britain, I don't know. There's been a similar process here recently with new gambling legislation coming through, and that has been debated and discussed and so on. And it was interesting that the Department of Justice here rejected the affordability aspect of it because they found it was impractical and open to abuse. Because one aspect of it was that the bookmakers would be held liable for dependents and creditors and so on for people who had gambled money they shouldn't have. And the point they made was that, well, you could use this, you know, you could run up a small gambling debt to use it as a way of getting out of bigger debts that you had. So they felt it was abuse. So, you know, I just, as you say, Tom, you know, we're looking across the water at it, and it just seems, I think you used the word draconian. I mean, that's what it is. You know, you're entitled to do what you want with your money. And if there is evidence, you, obviously you need protections there. But if there is evidence that you're doing it irresponsibly, you know, then that's to be dealt with. But, you know, picking up your average punter for and scrutinising what they're doing. And, I mean, the other thing is, I mean, where does GDPR come into all this? Or has that gone out of the window in Britain with Brexit?
Well, because it's a great question, yeah. I mean, it's not. Those regulations are still in place. But, obviously, there is some data security issues around asking your gran for their bank statements to send them off to someone who's working in the affordability team of a bookmaker. Not exactly high on anyone's list of things they want to do.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense. So, I mean, as I said, we've recently had the affordability aspect pushed back here, and there are still, you know, regulations and measures going to be updated. The Irish gambling laws go back to 1956, so they're over 60 years old, and they needed updating. And there will be advertising bans come in and so on, and there will be bans on promotions and inducements and free bets and so on. And that's all fine, you know, you can see the value in those kind of things, but, you know, this affordability nonsense, it just doesn't make any sense.
Well, that those Irish reforms are definitely a subject for another day, Richie, and we'll return to them. Let's hope there's some more common sense shown in Dublin than there is in Westminster. James, we're going to come to you for the final story. Dublin Racing Festival entries out this week. What was your big takeaway?
Yes, well, it seems that David Russell will be at the Dublin Racing Festival, but not too many British horses, by the sounds of it. So we had 117 entries made across the 8 Grade 1 races, but only 2 British-trained horses. Extremely disappointing when you sort of think about it. We've All Been Caught for Nigel Tristan Davis is in there, and So Royale. But other than that, it's sort of a bit of racing sort of Delia Smith moment, sort of where are you sort of stuff. So, yeah, really disappointing turnout, especially as we had... I'm not sure who it was in your team, Richie, that spoke to Leopardstown, but they said over 20% of the sort of tickets have been sold to a British audience.
Yeah, so the very popular with British racegoers and punters, but not with British trainers, apparently.
So I think that this sort of highlights a few points, which perhaps we already know. You know, is this another sign that the dominance is with Ireland, and almost that British trainers don't want to go over there and take them on their backyard because they feel they're going to be beaten? Is that the position we've got into where we're sort of just lying down and saying, well, we're not going to beat them, so we're not even going to try? You know, for a sport, that is extremely concerning. Or is this a sign that actually there are simply so many opportunities to run these good horses? You know, we've talked about the race programme, we've talked about how horses can find the easier option. Is this just another example? I mean, there's 8 Grade 1 races over there, but yet you've still got the options this weekend. For example, there's good racing at Lingfield, there's good racing at Ascot, Haydock's got some good cards, even Taunton's got a pretty decent race as well. So there's so many options for these horses to avoid each other and sort of springboard themselves to Cheltenham's and Aintree's. But I suppose the third thing is, maybe this is just nothing at all. Maybe this is just a case of, well, I want to run my horse at Cheltenham and take on the Irish there, but sending horse to, over to Ireland, having a hard race, coming back, that doesn't quite fit in the programme. I mean, there's...
So a little bit too close.
A little bit close. Yeah, that window is perhaps of fitness and just making sure they're absolutely at their peak for, say, Cheltenham, if that's their main target. So there's a few different ways to look at it. I mean, speaking personally, I think it probably highlights the two things I said. I think that there are too many opportunities. It may be worth touching on that on the flat this week, we had a bit of news regarding some of the cut down of programmes. Six listed races, and 3 Group 3. So the idea of that programme being too big is already being looked at on the flat in the off-season. And I think, second of all, I think it is a sign that the power is with Ireland. And perhaps, you know, we discussed, I know you guys discussed Willie Mellons the other week. Sort of power he has. I've got here that 75.2% of the entries at the meeting are for Willie Mellons, Gordon Elliott and Henry de Bromhead, which is quite incredible, really. I'm sure Richie's got some interesting points. Maybe that is just a sign that perhaps British racing is in a really sort of difficult place in terms of that top quality horse, and they are just taking that easy option. I mean, that's their job as trainers.
Keith, if you were looking at the potential top-tier British runners who could have headed over to Dublin, what sort of chance would you have given them? Do you think they could have gone over there and been competitive, or were the trainers right to swerve this because they'd be fishing in awfully deep waters there?
Generally, it's the latter. Obviously, you've got horses like Constitution Hill that could have gone over and smashed up Honeysuckle in the Irish Champion Hurdle, but that his season's not built around doing that. And Nicky Henderson's got his habits, and they generally don't involve going to Leopardstown. And habits of trainers is a big factor, as is, as James points out, the bloated programme here. We definitely need a little bit of a pruning of that. As horse numbers go down, you've got to do it. It just makes sense. But the other thing to consider as well here is, yes, you've got 75% of the entries are Mullins, Elliott and De Bromhead, but an overwhelming majority, or no, sorry, a sizable amount of the best horses in Britain are also in relatively few hands. I looked at the 50 top performances in Britain on RPRs this season. I took out all the Irish and I took out Skelton and Nichols. The reason I took out Skelton and Nichols is those guys are not interested in winning a Euro because their focus is a British trainer's title. So I don't expect those guys to come across. They set their stall out very early doors and say, we want to win the British Trainers' Championship. Nichols sends the odds want to punch us down, but the British season's finished by then. So for that reason, those 2 yards, two of our potentially three biggest yards, aren't never going to send horses to that meeting because they're not interested in winning Euros. Nicky Henderson is a man of deep habit, and as we know, he's not the most adventurous campaign, or certainly less adventurous than Nichols and Skelton himself. So he's unlikely to send his horses in that 50. Venetia had for one of them, the best of them by a long way, was Long Press, who obviously isn't going to run at all this season now, or certainly not this side of Cheltenham, or in Cheltenham. So there, we've got that to consider. And yeah, there is just an instance there of a lot of these races are too hot. There is one exception, and that is the Irish Gold Cup, which for me, it's often Ireland's B team that runs in the Irish Gold Cup. The very best of those Irish horses get campaigned around a Christmas run, a gap to Cheltenham. Now, we do that in this country and have done for a very long time because of the way the pattern's set up. You know, we've got the King George, you've got the old pillar, the Cotswold Chase and the Denman, but they are very much seen as prepped for horses that need it. Whereas the big race is the King George and has been since, you know, whenever. And what you end up with then is that's the way our season works. But the Irish season's not quite like that. However, there is an option there in that Irish Gold Cup. I see a lot of horses in that list of 37 I had left who could have been contenders in that Irish Gold Cup and maybe should be looking at that race because they're not going to beat Galopin de Sean. They're not going to beat, you know, Protectorate. They're not going to beat these top notchers in the Gold Cup. They should be looking at that Grade One opportunity. But if you take each case on its merits, the gaps really aren't particularly there. And the trainers that could send their horses have one reason or another of varying degrees of sort of validity for not sending their horses there. So it's one of those, there's a lot of factors going into it. I would highlight those ones I've made as extra reasons as to why these horses aren't going across. I don't think we're missing too many, to be honest. I don't think there's too many British horses there that go, the meeting's missing them. But trainers need to spot the opportunities, and for that reason, I think they need to be looking at certain races. And as I say, the Irish Gold Cup's the one that tends to be year on year the one that you can target.
Richie, let's finish by talking about what is going to be there rather than what's not there. What are you most looking forward to from the Dublin Racing Festival?
I think the Champion Hurdle is probably going to be the race, isn't it? I mean, Galopin de Champ is likely to win the Gold Cup, you would imagine. The Champion Hurdle, you got State Man against Honeysuckle, you know, the rising star against the established power. Obviously, she was beaten by Tio Poo at Fairy House, but I think that's going to be a hell of a clash. You'll have the likes of Boban in there as well. It won't be just the two of them. But we'll get a real good idea in the Irish Champion Hurdle of Honeysuckle's level at the moment. You know, the jury is out on whether she underperformed or whether she just was beaten by a better couple of horses on the day at Fairy House. I'm inclined to think she ran okay, and I think we'll see a much more potent rival at Leopardstown. But will that be good enough to beat State Man, who has looked exceptional in the Margiana and in the Matheson at Christmas? The Irish Champion Hurdle is probably the race on the Sunday that we're all going to be looking forward to. And maybe just worth mentioning, Tom, we still don't have the entries for the handicaps and so on, the shoulder races around the Grade Ones. So maybe there'll be some British entries in there. Or more British entries. I know we have a couple who saw Royal as well. But it is, overall, it's a frustration because, you know, for Cheltenham to work the way it does, there's the international element with Ireland coming in and making that bit of Anglo-Irish rivalry. And it's the national hunt game, and it's always thrived on that. And, you know, you go back and you look at the Irish Gold Cups and Champion Hurdles of previous years, which are Collier Bays and your Jadamis, and all these great horses coming over and winning them. And those races were always in late January and early February. And it doesn't wash with me, the timing aspect. It just, I think it's more to do with convenience and you know, a preconception that it doesn't work, because, you know, it's happened both ways. I've just mentioned the likes of Collier Bay and Joe Damien and all those good horses that used to come and used to go on to check and run perfectly well and win. But the same, like Willie Mullins used to send over in Orgamine last year, for example. He'd do it again this year. Undersaw used to go over for the Clarence House Chase. We've had horses like Spirit Leader winning the Tote Gold Trophy in February and going on to win at Cheltenham. So those horses are travelling over and back. Look at Undersaw. Like he was a real free runner, high energy. And you're talking about a trip to Britain and back, and to go on and win a Ryanair after that, as he did, I think, in 2017, when, if I remember right, the Clarence House was delayed a week. Mm. You know, so it's to do with the mindset, and Keith touched on it there. It just doesn't really enter the trainers' heads as an option. You know, come to Punchestown later on in the year when everything is done and dusted. Some of them will come to Fairy House after Cheltenham. But they just don't really factor in the Dublin Racing Festival. And I was looking at this recently because I commented on it a few years ago. In 2019, I think there was four British horses came over. Three of them got round. One of them was Labago Roy, who won. And the three of them took home grand early. Mm. Look at the prize money situation in Britain. You know, and it's a world removed from what's there. So overall, I'd be slightly disappointed. Hopefully there will be some more British entries in the handicaps and the shoulder rail, because for the thing to take off the way we all wanted to, you need that bit of Anglo-Irish rivalry. It's what has made Cheltenham great. It's, you know, the Irish going to win at Aintree and so on. It's a massive thing for us and for the game as a whole. So hopefully over time they will see the light, but there is a general reluctance there to kind of factor it in simply to Cheltenham.
Yeah.
The other factor, Richie, is that the Willie Mullins has so many horses lined up that can go DRF and some that go Cheltenham and some that go Aintree and Punchestown, because he barely trains them before Christmas. Whereas in Britain, if you didn't, if you took that similar attitude, you've missed the November meeting, you've missed Betfair Chase weekend, you've missed the Coral Gold Cup, you missed Tingle Creek. The seasons are set up slightly differently, and the British one makes it easier, because I'm not going to give them a free pass on this. I think they skip too much. The idea that Dan Skelton come out and the horses need that time is a massive generalisation, and he's a better horseman than I, but I would back that all day. The way the two patterns are set up does give them that excuse.
It does, yeah. And as you say, Willie has traditionally, and this is the case for a long time, he has started his horses late and campaigned them so that they peak at the spring festivals. Again, this is something I touched on recently when they were talking about bringing the John Durkin forward and so on, and you're asking Willie to bring the horses out next week or two early, and he's not inclined to do that. So I'll be interested to see that, how that pans out next year. He has always been inclined to wait. And if he has to run them for the first time at Christmas, he's happy to do that because he wants them in February, March and April.
Okay, guys, thanks very much. We're going to call a halt there. We could be chatting for hours about these topics, but it falls to me to determine what's going to go on the front page, James. And I don't think there's going to be any shocks at all when I come down very firmly on the side of David Russell. Just a huge story, this top sportsman returning from retirement, unexpected final hurrah. It's going to be a huge talking point over the next 8 weeks and possibly into Cheltenham as well. So that's our front page story of the week. It only remains for me to direct you towards our latest Members Club Ultimate offer. It's £10 per month for the first 3 months. There's a link below. Gets you access to digital newspaper, to all the top journalism from our key experts on this show and beyond, tipping from Priceways and Paul Keighley, replays, special features on our cards. The list goes on and on. It's the ultimate punting package. And if you don't have it already, please do check out that offer. And while you're at it, download our new app as well, which is the perfect on-the-go companion for every racing fan in Britain and Ireland, and indeed beyond. Why not? So thank you so much for joining us today. I've been Tom Kerr, delighted to have been joined by James Stevens, Richie Forrestal, and Keith Melrose, and of course, by you at home. Please do join us again next week for more discussion on the front page.